Content notices for this show include a discussion of anti-Semitism, Holocaust, and classism in our deep dive, and also a quick reference to Jeepers Creepers, the pedophilia of the Victor Salva, the creator of Jeepers Creepers, and the transphobia turfdom of J.K. Rowling.
Greetings, dear listeners. You are listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. I'm Pastor Emily, and I'm an extra jingle bell that fell to the ground.
Okay. And I am Pace, and I am totally rocking Aunt Dorothy vibes. Today and all days.
Truth. Truth. I mean, if I were a character, I would probably be Max. Because Christmas. So, Pace, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I feel like this question gets more and more loaded with time. Maybe it's just the closer we get to Christmas. Everything in my life is chaos right now. One of my housemates has COVID. It's a mess. Everything's a mess. We're trying really, really hard not to have everyone in the house get COVID. And it costs a lot of money to do that. So Hopefully the HEPA filter is what it says it should be. And our masks are good and all of those things. But yeah, today is day two. Yesterday was 0 day. The day of the positive test. So today is dun, dun, dun. One day later. So we have like the incubation stage to like anxiously wait through to see if anybody else gets it.
That's real. That's real.
Yeah.
Not to mention all the pastor stress this time of year.
Right? The pastor stress, the family stress, the queer holiday stress.
All of it. Just bring it all on me. The first holiday, the first Christmas of going through a divorce. Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard and it's messy. And I feel like that is also in some ways like the future now. That like we live in a space where it's such a capitalist hellscape. The government has abandoned all care and concern for pandemic mitigation. Inflation is out of control because the government refuses to control it, though they could. Wages are ridiculous, so nobody gets paid enough to like be able to afford anything. It's just like, yeah.
Yeah. Not, no bueno. Yeah. Yeah.
But then maybe that's ready.
Go ahead.
Yeah. But then maybe that is like the exact thing, and we better watch out because if I write any notes or make any wishes, Krampus might start heading our way, and it'll be even worse.
Right. Spoilers, but I really kind of dug this movie. But anyway, we'll get into this in a little bit. We should probably check in on our Advent Misophony calendar quick.
Oh, yeah.
So today, the day this episode is dropping, is, in fact, Christmas Day. And so One of the prompt for today is to watch something about the first Christmas. I feel like this movie could, if you stretch it, really could, because I mean they like sing things like Silent Night and stuff and they're referencing, but like it's not quite the first Christmas. But for the first Christmas, I'm watching The Nativity Story, directed in 2000 It came out in 2006, directed by Catherine Hardwicke, who directed the first Twilight movie. So connection to H&AC there.
Oh, nice. I am planning to watch The Star. So that
isn't
is
that the Disney?
Yeah.
The little Disney short. I watched that last year when we did our Advent movie calendar thing last year.
Okay, so I haven't seen it. So that's why I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. But so we haven't had this whole week yet. But in the last week, we also, it has been Hanukkah all week. And so our prompt for the day that we are recording this episode is to have a Hanukkah film. And so I am excited to check out Menorah in the Middle, which is coming, which is a new release this year. I already watched a Rugrats Hanukkah special because I love the Rugrats Hanukkah special.
I might have to watch that movie with you because my original choice for Hanukkah was to watch An American Tale. I started that movie and I realized I hate it. So I didn't finish it. I got like 25 minutes in. I'm like, this is so goddamn boring. I can't sit through the rest of this.
It's the Fievel one, right?
I loved it as a kid. Like, I really did. Yeah. But as an adult, it just is not into
it. Interesting, because I was like, I really want to watch yours too. So, interesting. We'll have to check that out together. But yeah, also coming up tomorrow is the beginning of Kwanzaa. End of Hanukkah, beginning of Kwanzaa. So I'm excited to watch, at a minimum, the Proud Family 7 Days of Kwanzaa special, like their Kwanzaa episode, which I really enjoyed as a kid and I watched last year and I just really like that.
Awesome.
That one. Yeah.
I will quick say two shout outs for this podcast. If you're trying to watch our podcast episodes to fit in somewhere on Advent Misophony, this movie would count for quite a few that we've already done, days that we've already done. So it could be anti-capitalist, it could be snow, it could be Christmas horror, controversial holiday, all that stuff.
Holiday horror.
Real meaning is not family. That's also kind of one of the other things of that. Going forward, though, I would say this would probably count for tragedy grief, even though it has a positive ending. Yeah.
Does it have a positive ending?
Kind of ish, maybe.
I don't know that it does.
Good point. We'll get into that in our deep dive, I think. And our next movie we're covering will come out the Thursday before New Year's, this coming Thursday. And we will be watching Terror Train for the podcast. And that would definitely work for a set on New Year's Eve. That's one of the reasons we chose it for that day. And also, you can watch it and then come back and listen to Emily's thoughts about, I think this is the first like classic slasher movie that you're watching.
Yeah.
Like pre-Freddy era slasher.
Yeah. I don't know that. I know growing up, I saw like a couple scary movies. Like The Ring, but I don't know that I've seen slasher movies, so yeah. That'll be interesting to see what comes of that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Any other announcements or anything? I can't think of anything right now. Oh, our live show is like in less than a week, just over a week from this episode coming out, so that's exciting. Yeah.
Super exciting. I'm really excited about it. And it should be a fun adventure. So make sure if you can that you're going to come check us out. We are the first podcast up at the Q Christian Fellowship Conference. And so we are going to be up way too early in the morning, but hopefully plenty caffeinated. And we'll see whoever we see and we'll dive deep into talking about Saved.
Yeah. So definitely check out that movie ahead of time. It's really fun. Of course, does a dog diet? There's quite a few
yes.
trauma-y things in there, like queer and religious stuff. So check it out. But it's in the context of a comedy, and it's just a really fun movie that I'm excited to get into.
Yeah. Me too. Speaking of really fun movies.
Yay, transitions.
Our film for this episode is Krampus, directed by Michael Dougherty. Is it Dougherty or we? I had this.
Or Dougherty. Yeah, Dougherty. We haven't figured that out. He's a American, so my guess would be Dougherty, but who knows? Yes. I mean, it's not like we couldn't take 5 minutes to look it up, but that's not what we're about this podcast. I mean, we're both tired and it's a week before Christmas.
I was going to say, we both work at churches. It's a week before, it's less than a week before Christmas.
Yeah. Usually we try to be a little bit more ahead of time for this podcast, but this season we just both kind of fell out of control because we both got like jobs and life
it's
stuff,
true so. We did like get jobs just right before the season was supposed to start.
Yeah,
I didn't think about that. Yeah,
but anyway, what was your and it came out in 2015. What was your first time seeing this film?
Well, I didn't say I don't know the movies, so I didn't say where people might know the director from.
Oh yeah, Michael Dougherty has directed two other movies beyond this. Trick or Treat, which is a fun anthology movie that came out, I want to say 2007. And then Godzilla, King of the Monsters, which came out 2019, a few years after this one, and is part of the Legendary Films Monsterverse. He co-wrote Godzilla versus King Kong, or King Kong versus Godzilla, whichever comes first, that came out just last year. So though he didn't direct it, I love him. I've seen all of the films he's been part of, and I just think he really gets the horror comedy down really well, and there's a good mix of it, similar to like Gremlins or something. Like, it's just a very fun, like, horror, campy, scary, all of the above.
Yeah. So my first memory or experience of this film was last year, so no drinks for people this time. It was last year. Did we watch it for a movie commentary, or was it just for Advent Misfini?
We just watched it for Advent Misfini, which at the time was just called Advent Movie Calendar.
Yes, yeah. For our Advent Movie Calendar last year, which actually encompassed the whole Christmas cycle. Yeah. We watched it. So maybe that was like some of the hints at like, I'm more open to scary movies than I claim to be, that I willingly watched this movie.
Yeah. And I think I was able to convince you, because it was for the prompt Christmas horror or holiday horror last year. Mm-hmm. And we also watched Love Actually, which is horrific for different reasons.
Kind of horror. Yeah.
But I feel like I was able to convince you to watch this because I said it was a horror comedy and not actually that scary. So I'm not sure if you will agree with that, but that was how I presented it to you, I think.
Yeah. That seems pretty accurate, although our jump count for this episode at the end will illuminate some things for our listeners in multiple ways.
Interesting. Yes. Mm-hmm. This one does have a few intentional jump scares, I will say that. I first watched this movie with Emily last year.
Really?
So, yeah.
Really? So, I didn't realize that was your first time. That's so exciting. We had the same first time watching a scary movie.
Oh my goodness. I was trying to make a sexual pun about that, but I couldn't think of it fast enough. Anyway, we both lost our V card to this movie at the same time.
Something like that.
Whatever. Virginity's a construct, folks. It doesn't matter anyway.
It's true.
Anyway, so I for this podcast, I watched it again for the second time with Emily. I think that was also your second time watching it.
Yes, but indeed.
Then earlier today, I watched the Krampus Naughty Cut, which I loved. It. I was so worried it wouldn't come in time because it was supposed to be delivered yesterday, but the people did not deliver it, even though they swung by. So I don't know what that was about. Huh. But anyway, it was delivered this morning, thankfully, and I was able to watch the Naughty Cut, which, first of all, the 4K restoration, beautiful. And secondly, the Naughty Cut, I really liked. So I've now watched this 3 times, and I'll talk a little bit more about the Naughty Cut in the background behind the scenes.
Speaking of which, I thought you were transitioning.
Okay, so I'm transitioning. So behind the scene, I'll talk more about it behind the scenes, which is right now. So behind the scenes. So Naughty Cut of the movie is not that much longer. It's like 6 or 7 minutes longer, but it has a few deleted scenes, a few alternate takes, and then quite a bit more blood and gore. And it was edited down from this version to appease the MPAA, which for a long time has always been obnoxious about horror movies and just
that's the cool ones who do the ratings.
Yeah, they like to target things like queer sexuality and blood and stuff, but yet we can have action movies with tons of blood, but if it's a horror movie, no. Or we can have lots of toxic masculinity and female nudity, but any queer nudity or male nudity is like nope, stuff like that. So we don't like the MPAA here at Horror Nerds at Church, or at least Pace doesn't.
I was gonna say that's most, good to know.
Most horror podcasts don't, though, because they pull shit like this. Like, let's cut out some scenes and make this movie like the Naughty Cut. There's no, anyway. I'll get off my rant about Naughty Cut, but basically, it's cute, it's fun. The Naughty Cut has a few more character moments, which are like one of which is it. We'll get to this in a deep dive, but there's some a little bit of like classist undertones and stuff like that. And then this, some of the scenes that they cut out kind of combat that or challenge that a little bit more, so it's not just this like straightforward we're better than them, but it's challenged a little bit in both the characters' conversation and stuff. So stuff like that I wish had kept the cut. Krampus, do you know much about Krampus, the character beyond the folk character beyond the movie?
So I think it is connected to the character in Slovak culture that is called a chert. It's like a little demonish character. It is not nearly the size of Krampus, but it is like for Sveti Mikuláš, which is St. Nicholas Day, on December 6th, it is like the chert is in imagery is depicted with like with Santa, kind of like the size of an elf maybe. So I remember that from when I was in Slovakia, from the year that I spent in Slovakia. We didn't really talk about it a lot. I was there with the like I was working with the church there, and so we had a like we had a Saint a Sveti Mikuláš day, an event, but we and I don't think we had a chert there, but I remember seeing it in stuff and I remember hearing about it. I just don't remember a whole ton of details, but I was looking at the notes that you typed up, right? And so like to see that Krampus was the friend or helper of the Austrian version of St. Nicholas, I was like, okay, this is probably Krampus or chert.
I'll have to go back. So I got most of this information that I'm about to share about Krampus from the Stuff You Missed in History Class episode called Krampus and Friends Holiday Special. It was really fun. But they go through a lot of it now. Listen, podcast. But yeah, it has a lot of It probably does go into Chert and stuff like that. It talks about a lot of the folkloric people around St. Nicholas, aside from St. Nicholas himself. So it's really fun. So basically, the Austrian and German St. Nicholas, Krampus is the friend or helper. The Austrian and German St. Nicholas friend and helper, he is celebrated on December 5th, which is called Krampusnacht, the night before St. Nicholas is celebrated. So Santa, we get this kind of binary here. Santa is for the good kids, but he brings Krampus along. Either Krampus goes along ahead of Santa, or they go along together, and Krampus deals with the bad kids. Krampus brings bad children coal, and extremely bad children get put in a sack and then taken back to his lair to be tortured or eaten. He's often seen with a whip that he uses to like whip children with and misbehaving children with. Krampus's origin, folkloric origin, is actually Norse before it kind of got adopted into this Germanic Christmas tradition. But in Norse mythology, his grandpa is actually Loki, so he's kind of the grandson of Loki. And they go much more in depth on Krampus in that episode, so that was just some like highlights, but definitely recommend checking that out. And then the last thing I have about the behind the scenes is Michael Dougherty always wanted to do a Christmas horror movie similar to Gremlins. He said he was inspired after receiving a Krampus holiday card. And that's actually one of the big traditions in many Germanic countries, is the Krampuskarten, the Krampus cards that they send out as kind of like jokes to friends and stuff like that.
Almost as cool as the holiday cards that are available from Horror Nerds at Church's site, which we'll link to in case you also want to send out something closer to Epiphany cards.
And
early jump on Valentine's cards, because we have those on the store too.
And we also have New Year's cards, so could get a New Year's card.
There you go.
And we do in fact have one Krampuskarten card on there, the ho ho horror one, since Krampus is on that one. I guess we can get into the movie and just kind of go through our favorite scenes. My one sentence summary, and I'm dying to hear yours, is Krampus teaches the family the true meaning of Christmas with much blood, guts, and gore.
That's fair. Mine is nostalgia for what probably never actually was leads to death, destruction, and life in a snow globe.
Dun dun dun.
Right, I was like, this is like the first one that doesn't have like a real dun 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 sense to it that mine usually do.
So I'll just kind of go through some of my favorite scenes and you can go through yours, of course. I just love the opening juxtaposition of like the most wonderful time of year, one of those like holiday classic songs, and just joyfully singing as people are fighting over the most obnoxious of things and grabbing like stuffed animal toys, which are like $20. Like, really, you're gonna fight over $20 stuffed animal?
It's so perfectly done, and like, certainly the day after Thanksgiving is like mass chaos and all of that stuff, but like these days it's a whole different level, and it has encroached enough into Thanksgiving Day that it's, I think, slightly less violent. But it's hard because, and this we'll get into maybe more in the like classism of the that's in the movie, but like Black Friday is some of the times when like that's the only time certain things are affordable for folks, and so like there's this like weird like looking down on people who do it but also doing it. But What's trashy when you're poor and classy when you're rich? Black Friday.
True story.
Definitely love that one.
I also love Max's excuse for getting in the fight was because he was under the influence, and then we learned that what he means is under the influence of candy canes and hot chocolate, which is like totally me.
Oh my gosh, it's so perfect. I was like, yes, yes, please. I would like to be under the influence of candy canes and hot chocolate all the time. Also, like the whole dynamic between the two families, the two sisters' families, is just like the like shittiness, the bullying, the like the way Max's sister is like, don't start anything, don't start anything, when it is clear that Stevie and Jordan are starting stuff.
Right.
And Max is responding and reacting to it. But, like, they're starting stuff. When he responds, she says, don't start stuff, Max. And it just – it feels so, like, victim-blamey. So, like, in a like, systemic level, the way that violence works and the levels of violence, that the level of violence that really initiates things is the one that is not recognized. And then it's the response to that. The riots, the protests, the uprisings, those sorts of things that are called the starting of the violence, when the violence happened way before with economic devastation and overpolicing and all of those things. So deep diving into that one real fast.
Right, already.
But, yeah. Oof. I just was like, no, let him be mad. He didn't start it. Also, I love Max. He's just like so precious and like wants to believe in this like beautiful thing. And then he writes this letter to Santa and then he gets teased about it. And the letter to Santa is like good.
So sweet and so caring for his family.
Right? Like there's some stuff that he wants probably, but like he has this great insight into his parents that they just miss each other, that they don't they're able to spend as much time together, and his family and his sister and his cousins and all of that stuff. And then he has this like rip up the letter and send it out the window moment that is very much in the style of Mary Poppins and the letter for the new nanny up the chimney.
Yep.
I don't know if I ever thought I would compare Mary Poppins to Krampus, but here we are.
Here we are.
Also, Omi is the true hero of the entire movie. She is spectacular. I love her.
Overall, I love her, but at the same time, it's one of those, like, you couldn't have communicated this earlier as, like, a warning for your family of what will happen if they... going to wait until the people are already dying before you finally decide to communicate?
She did try to warn people, but yes, she could have been telling this story growing up. Although, in my experience, when people of her generation had traumatic experiences, one of the things they did was not talk about it. Like, truth. I never heard about my grandfather's time in the war, ever.
That's why there are lasting generational traumas and consequences. So I'm not letting her off the hook, even if it was
part
of her
upbringing. Yeah. I feel for her. I don't know what it was like for her to grow up in Germany in that time. Like, I don't know what all her actual life was growing up in Germany.
Fair point.
When she was a kid. But once when she figures it out, then she's like, oh, this is what's happening. Like, she knows what's happening and she knows what needs to be done, and nobody believes her, right? But she's like, don't let the fire die, don't let the fire die. Which Nerds at Church just recorded our episode for Christmas Day, and it so it made me think of John 1. It's like the flashlight shines in the darkness, the fire burns in the fireplace, and the darkness does not overcome it. And I was like, that's the warmth of the fire keeps Krampus out until the fire dies. Dun dun dun.
Oh my
gosh. I got a dun dun dun.
You did. There's a bit of toxic masculinity in this that you picked up on. If you want to talk a little bit about that too.
Yeah, the like, okay, particularly Howard's constant refrain of a shepherd's got to protect his flock. And by protect, he means guns and violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's so much wrong with that, right? Because you know the shepherd and flock is supposed to be, like, is Christian imagery in this, like, Christian supremacy, Christian nationalism, conservative Christianity thing.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. also, like, pastors use that language to talk about pastors of congregations as the shepherds. And I, like, heard it the other day, and I was so annoyed because it's like, no, you don't change species. Like, if you're a sheep and Jesus is the good shepherd, then when you become a pastor, you're still a sheep and Jesus is still the good shepherd. But, like, so much of our theology and, like, just pop theology is right. this, like, need to protect at all costs, and that's not faithful to Christianity as I that's not faithful right. to Christ and the I mean, way he models.
Jesus as the good shepherd legit is like, I'm just gonna abandon my entire flock to go search for the one that ran off. It's like, that's not good shepherding, and actually, that's kind of the point.
Actually, it is good shepherding. I so Nerds at Church this last Easter had a shepherd on, and we talked about that because that's one of her one of their favorite Bible passages, and like the abandoning the sheep to go find one flock makes sense, mostly because there were likely other shepherds there, but the like laying down your life for the sheep, so getting in between the wolf and the sheep, also is like actually spot on.
Interesting
shepherding. We'll link to that episode in our show notes for our folks.
Last thing I have for this, really, I guess we should talk about the ending, because I feel like this might be the point of our disagreement of whether or not it's a happy ending. But Aunt Dorothy, though, totally pays. I said in the beginning, but I stand by that. She is just
the
type of, like, trashy, and I use that in, like, a John Waters kind of way. And Emily watched their first early John Waters movie earlier this year, so they know what I mean now. But, like, this trashy, like, campy, over-the-top, constantly drunk, fun aunt, that just seems like Pace vibes all about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I do love Aunt Dorothy. I do think the ending, like, it's fascinating because there is, Max is nostalgic for something that probably didn't actually exist, but he was a child and so didn't know how it didn't exist, because the adults probably just, like, worked harder to hide it when the kids were littler. But also there is a sense that, like, he does know that there is something about Christmas that matters, and that, like, all of the bullshit that they're doing and putting up with isn't what it is about. And then ultimately he's like, okay, take me instead of my cousin. And then still, and then the cousin still gets tossed in, and Max gets tossed in, and then they fill it the rest of the way full with resin and flip it upside down, and they've just made a snow globe. because that's what I watch on TikTok way too much.
I love it.
They probably wouldn't fill it with resin, to be fair, but
yeah. My understanding of it, of the ending, is that Krampus uses the snow globe to keep an eye on the family to make sure they don't lose the Christmas spirit again, but the family is not literally inside of a snow globe.
Oh, I definitely assumed that they were inside the snow globe, because otherwise what about grandma's family? Like, she didn't,
but she also did not apologize or take back the wish.
Oh. Huh.
So Krampus takes back the wish. Everybody wakes up and they wake up changed. So there is an ontological shift that happened.
Big
or at very birds. Least, yeah, or at very least a paradigm shift. And I'll say what both of those are in a second. In the family, because of the events of Krampus visiting their household, yet so they're left with like the memory and probably trauma of that event while being allowed to like live out the rest of their lives is my interpretation of it. And then there's always that better watch out because Krampus is gonna keep an eye on you just to make sure you don't slip back into your old ways.
Yeah,
the snow globe. That was my interpretation of the ending, but it could also be they're trapped now literally in a snow globe. Like, I don't know.
Well, because like definitely he looks out the window and sees his neighborhood as like pre-Krampus neighborhood, but then they're the only house in the snow globe. There is something like it is reminding me of the conversation we had on Nerds at Church about dreams and the trope of like it was all just a dream, which definitely is at play here, right? Like they wake up and they're all smiling and happy, and it's not until he pulls out the bell that then everybody's faces convey some sort of like trauma, fear, remembering. And so like my interpretation of it was that Krampus put them in a snow globe and then they get to have this like false happiness because that was the wish was for them all to be happy. And then the bell is like, but that was just a wish and that is not reality and that is not actually possible. And the bell reminds them of that. And so then it's all of a sudden this like idyllic dream Christmas is returned to the state of being a nightmare because it's impossible. And so like then they're trapped in Christmas Day happiness.
Yeah.
Forever. That was my interpretation. So like.
I like that interpretation too.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I like them both. And now I want a sequel.
There is a graphic novel, and this might spoil it. There's a graphic novel prequel that came out to tie in with the movie. And the graphic novel prequel seems to agree with my interpretation. It says, the Krampus Shadow of St. Nicholas revealed that anyone spared by Krampus will be kept on surveillance by him through their respective snow globes in his workshop.
Okay.
But since that's not actually mentioned in the movie, we can still have your canon be legit because what did Everything Everywhere All at Once teach us?
It's legit somewhere.
Yep.
Yeah. That's fascinating. It didn't even like cross my mind because I think because it zooms out from the house into the snow globe, into the. So it didn't even cross my mind that like that might just be a way of monitoring.
Well, it made me think a lot of the ending of the original Men in Black film where it zooms out and it shows that the galaxy is actually like a golf ball or something essentially of an alien and like or marble, I think it is. They're playing marbles. And of course, that if that were literally true, then that would mean all sorts of things about our galaxy that are not possible. So I was just like thinking, I think this is supposed to be read in a
interesting. I've never actually seen the Men in Black movies.
Future season. I don't know how that would even fit into a season because those are decided like anything can be horror as if you want it to be, I know, but those are decidedly like not even falling into horror tropes at all.
Really?
It's just like
they're like
comedy
aliens.
Action.
Oh, okay.
All comedy action pretty much.
Maybe a movie commentary during an upcoming season that we have not yet announced because we're saving the announcement-ish.
Yes. Ish. I mean, people can figure it out, but yes. Yeah. We're not very good at keeping secrets here at Nerds at Church, but y'all know that.
We're terrible at it.
I guess we can get into a deep theological discussion, though.
Since we're already there.
Since we're already doing it. Yep. So before we do this, I just want to quick check in with Emily because this is relevant to the next, to the first point I have. But I was, as I was doing this, I was like, I think Emily might disagree with me on this particular thing. And that's not to say one interpretation is right or the other, but I think it'd be valuable to check in and we can both kind of lay out our cases for why not. But what are your thoughts about media responsibility in telling stories like this one?
So I am not sure what you're referring to exactly.
Okay. For instance, there is a transphobic comment in this film where the one daughter says about her cousins that she doesn't want to sleep with girls that pee standing up. And then there's kind of that running kind of gag about how masculine or butch the two girls are and stuff like that. So my comment is there are a variety of ways to think about this. And one of the ways is that movies shouldn't have this kind of stuff at all. Others, because it's kind of reifying social stereotypes and harm. Mm-hmm. Others are, it's okay to do it if you like comment on it and make it clear that it's wrong in some way. Then there are others who say, well, if films are meant to be a meta commentary, then as long as there's a meta commentary, it's okay. And then there's also just the idea that films and stories can depict real life. And since transphobia exists in real life, they can depict it without necessarily commenting directly on it, but just kind of giving a snapshot of this is how some families may interact in these realistic ways, and we're not going to like distinctly make a comment on it. And then there's some people who are like the Elon Musks of the world who are like, we can say anything we want without consequence, because that's, why would there be a consequence for saying harmful things about people?
Okay, that's helpful, because I was like, I know you're referring to specific things, but I wasn't sure if you what you're referring to.
Sure.
So I'm definitely not an Elon Musk.
Right.
Which will surprise no one. And I'm not a this can't ever exist in a movie or a TV show, but I do think that it needs to be, if it does exist, it should be addressed. Like having unchallenged transphobia, unchallenged anti-Semitism, unchallenged racism in a movie or a TV show is going to perpetuate harmful stereotypes and harmful beliefs. And that is irresponsible for me. That is irresponsible. It is poor. It is, as they say in Joan of Arc, as God tells Joan in Joan of Arcadia, a failure of imagination, right? If you cannot tell a story without reinforcing harmful tropes, stereotypes, whatever, then maybe you're just not a good storyteller, right? And I think of it a lot in terms of like stand-up comedy, where it's anything can be a topic. I think that anything can be a topic for joking, but not everyone can do that well. Not every joke about transphobia is a good joke, right? Like, it is a matter of, are we punching up or punching down? And I think that that, for me, carries over into other forms of media of, yeah, maybe it is that the meta commentary like pokes at why that's a harmful thing to say or why that trope is bad or whatever. But if nothing challenges it, then you're reinforcing that it's valid and that it's okay to believe those things. And that's not okay. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm at.
Not surprised, as I was. I feel like this is I feel like this was a good opportunity to bring this up, because I feel like we have been operating from these assumptions about the responsibility of media and these things mm-hmm. throughout the past two seasons of this podcast. And I think we are in slightly different spots, so it's good to be able to articulate that for our listeners to see this is mm-hmm. where we are coming from and why we feel these things. I want to say that for me, as with most things, there's contextual ways for media to exist that the rules change a little bit for me, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like if you're going to do a documentary about racism and you're exposing the racism of a particular organization or something, you might have footage displaying racist behaviors, and mm-hmm. like that would be something, and that since it's a genre of film that it's because of the genre that allows something like that to happen, where I wouldn't want something like that to be in this movie, for instance, where the family just goes full on saying racist shit that goes unchallenged and stuff in the context of this movie. But I do think that this film does not directly address within the dialogue or one-to-one correspondence the transphobia and classist undertones. There is more of a meta commentary in how we are seeing both of these families having assumptions about the other that mm-hmm. in moments throughout the film get challenged, and then they both are punished for not getting the Christmas spirit and being this way. So there is this kind of meta commentary on saying these things are wrong and these are the consequences, but it does not directly address them. I feel like that is okay. And I also feel like that is something that those of us who interact with media then have the responsibility of pointing that out and talking about it and stuff like, and unwrapping it a little bit for listeners or viewers or whatever. But of course, the ability for that to perpetuate harm is still an issue. And that's a problem with all media, is like, our biases run so deep that we do not even see the ways we perpetuate harm. So mm-hmm. we have to, so it's kind of like, this could turn into a really long discussion because I would have to start to articulate why I think certain strands of Lutheranism are wrong. But my point is, like, we're all bound to sin and stuff like that. So like, it's kind of works righteousness to say, the only type of media that can be created has no harmful biases, because that's not something that's not a goal that can ever become tangibly existent. But by doing the work of anti-racism, anti-bias and stuff within us, and by deconstructing these kind of racist, homophobic, queerphobic, all that stuff, tropes in media and stuff like that, by doing that, we are able to from that sort of paradigm, we are able to be more responsible in how we create media. And so that is kind of where I stand, which is a little bit of a both end, because I'm very non-binary and I don't like.
Well, and I I don't think that we're all that far off.
Yeah.
I do think that there is some nuance between like what we're each saying, particularly in the space of, like, I agree that it's impossible for any one person or any small group of people necessarily to make a film that doesn't have any implicit bias built into it. And we now have a culture that recognizes the importance of sensitivity readers, of consultants, of that sort of a thing. And mm-hmm. we do that for science. Like, Interstellar had a scientist consultant, Big Bang Theory did. Mm-hmm. And I think we, for the most part, are refusing to do it with movies and TV shows when it comes to implicit bias stuff. Yeah. I think there are a lot more authors who do that and who pay somebody to do that, but it still just is not recognized And I think there needs to be more pressure put on that. And partly having more diversity in the producers, in the directors, in the actors, in the writers, in all of those things helps weed out that stuff, right? Because
agreed,
there will be people in the room who know that that is harmful and don't let it move forward. And I think your example of the documentary, it's not just that like those scenes are okay because it's a documentary. It's because it's a documentary that is specifically about racism. And so it's going to challenge the racist scenes or explain them or deconstruct them, right? Like, it's not just that it's depicting it, because there are lots of really terrible documentaries that just depict the terrible thing.
I want to clarify that statement briefly, which is to say, I feel like there is pushback from people, from some people that would say that the difference is nonfiction versus fiction. So there is that I feel like this film is able to, in a meta way, deconstruct the classist undertones.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like this movie does that with classism. Yes. I agree.
Yeah. And the issue, I feel like a lot of people will say is, well, it's not clear because it's a story. There's not like this clear, very, like in nonfiction, we can have this way of saying this is this, and like framing it in a way where narrative in a fiction sense, some people create this binary that I guess you can't comment on stuff unless it's directly challenged, like through dialogue or something. And I just feel like that is.
Yeah. I don't think it has to be explicitly spelled out through dialogue, particularly for fiction. This movie does challenge, like there are classist assumptions in it, and it challenges a lot of those classist assumptions. Yeah. There are some that probably go unchallenged, but it really pushes back against the upper middle class family and the lower class family and the dynamics between the two. Like all of that stuff does get pushed against. I don't think they do that when it comes to the transphobia.
I agree there, but there's also, I agree. And,
so like, I think that's still a good example though, right? Like where we can say, the classism is not explicitly challenged. Nobody's commenting on the like classist assumptions and being like, actually, this is a classist assumption because of blah, 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 blah. Yeah. It's part of the story and it's deconstructed.
And to be clear, like the context of the transphobic remarks are always depicted as the character saying it should not be saying this. They're being mean. So it still has a level of commentary on this type of behavior is not okay. But then it doesn't take it the further step of saying why. Whereas with the classist undertones, like it's built into the story, like these are the harms and reasons why these assumptions are not okay. And so that's kind of the distinction for me between those.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
So, agreed. Yeah. We're pretty much on the same page. But I still feel like it was good to like talk it out, because we do have few nuance differences and stuff as well.
Yeah, and I do, that's the other thing, what you said I think at the end of when you were first talking about it, that like it is certainly, I understand it as our responsibility as podcasters and as people who talk about the movies, and in Nerds at Church we do this with the Bible and the spaces where we're like, we need to address the ableism in the Bible and that sort of thing. So I do think it is our responsibility to tackle stuff head on. But that's also the nature of the podcasts. Like it is by nature of being a podcast, we are talking about movies. So we should talk about the problematic stuff in them and the ways that,
And I've also said this before too, and I'll repeat it here again, because I feel like this is an important part too, is that I'm a Luther scholar, and I say that only to clarify, like I recognize in my doing queer readings of Luther and calling him out on his anti-Semitism, for instance, that he was of a certain time where he could say these things and it was considered par for the course. And yet mm-hmm. I still call him out because it still did real harm then and it still mm-hmm. can do real harm now.
Yeah.
Same thing with movies. So like when I'm watching an 80s slasher, I know it's going to be sexist going into it. But I can mm-hmm. still enjoy it and have fun. So yes, I'm going to call out the sexism that is part of the movies. And that's what you hear on Horror Nerds at Church. But I'll still rate like Friday the 13th, like a 9 out of 10. I don't even remember what we're rating it. Like Machetes, I think it was season 2. 9 out of 10 Machetes. So like, yeah. I want to be clear to you listeners that like a lot of pushback sometimes is like, well, can't you just enjoy something? It's like, I do. I genuinely enjoy a lot of the movies. Like all the movies I've covered on here so far, I've genuinely enjoyed. But that does not mean I can't be critical. I feel like you can be both end. Mm-hmm. So.
And I think one of the nuances between the two of us, right, is that I also am watching the movies and I take into account, like they get points off for rampant sexism, right? And so that does impact the score that I give them. But I also think about this and the Harry Potter books, movies, fandom, all of that stuff. And the Witch Please podcast, I think, did a really good job of like getting at this, which is pre J.K. Rowling outing herself as the TERF of TERFness, was to say, we can love these books and be critical about them. And like their entire podcast is built around a feminist critical reading of Harry Potter. And I think the space where it gets trickier for me is when, and the reason that I have stopped reading the Harry Potter books, the reason that we changed from Harry Potter at Church to from HP at Church to Nerds at Church is because J.K. Rowling has had many opportunities to grow and learn and change. And she has refused them, and not just refused them, she is intentionally getting worse. Like there was a thing on Twitter, and I have her blocked on Twitter, so I don't know if it was a fake screenshot or not, but there was a thing that was like, happy TERF miss, that like is supposedly one of her tweets. And like, she also has like actual tweets that people have shared of her, like when somebody's like, how do you not care that so many of your fans are so hurt by your words and actions? And she replies and she's like, or like, how do you live with that? And she replies and she's like, I just look at my royalty checks. And so then it's like, okay, this is a clear, she has even explicitly stated every penny that goes to Harry Potter, anything is a penny in support of transphobia. Yeah. And then it's like, there's room for negotiation, especially if the people have already died. And so there's like a limit to the amount that they can repent. And I believe that anybody could change, but J.K. Rowling is not, and is using her bank account to justify her harm. Yeah. And it's literally life or death for people. And so I'm just like, okay, that, and we've talked about it, and I don't know what will happen when we finally get to our werewolf season, whatever, you know, season 96 that is going to be.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a tough conversation because I have to figure out for myself how I feel about potentially having the third Harry Potter movie on for the werewolf episode, because it's so – I love Remus and I love Sirius and like – yeah. And you have to figure it out, and then we have to figure it out together. And so it's just
I've kind of – where I – this is like so far off topic, but like it still is related to all this. But yeah, like with the Harry Potter right now is one of those that is very hard for me to justify doing. We'll see where we are when we get to season 96,000. but like, to be clear, there are movies I will not do on this podcast right now. And one is the Jeepers Creepers franchise because of he was convicted for sexually abusing a minor and possessing child porn and rape and all this stuff. And it's like, I'm just not going to give any money to this man who's still alive and he completed his parole. He's still out there. He's still making movies. And it's like, no, not going to do it. So huge horror franchise. I don't give a fuck. I'm not doing it. Harry Potter is one of those where it's like, I'm kind of inclined to feel the same way, but at the same time, it's like there is also benefit in having a platform to publicly talk about why or how some of her werewolf shit is kind of transphobic too, like built right into the story.
And queerphobic and like super queerphobic. Yeah.
So, so all that's to say, listeners, like we really take this stuff seriously and talk it out and do our due diligence as best as we can.
And I think if we were not trans ourselves, it'd be a whole different story, right? Like Kay in our shifting to Nerds at Church, Kay and I have both talked together about this. And like, I lead that movement. I lead that conversation around Harry Potter because I am trans and she is not. And I think that gives more space, but like I have had cis people try to get me to give them a pass to go see the third movie and the Fantastic Beasts. And I'm like, no, you know better right now. And like, there are people who have seen it where it's like a complicated thing and like they're kids and there's peer pressure and all of that stuff. But like, no, you know better than to do this. You don't get a pass from me as your trans friend to do this. I did not go see it. You are not allowed to, like, if you want to consider yourself an ally, no, you don't get to.
And like, we could continue this conversation forever, but I think we should get back into deep.
Yes.
Like this is, we're like jamming on this, but, and it's important, but like, it's also something I know will just keep coming up as we keep talking about movies.
It's true. It's true.
Kind of one of those things. But continuing this movie, as you were talking about, so I legit typed this in as you were talking about this. So Omi, is that the Omi?
I call her Omi. Yeah.
The grandma
also, I have
character
a helicopter
Omi
above me, so
sorry
about noises.
But Omi survived this in her childhood in this village of Krampus coming and destroying her village for not having Christmas spirit in the German-Austrian region. We don't know how old she was, but the fact that this is allegedly a real creature that was able to do justice to help bring about change in people's hearts over fucking Christmas spirit did not stand up to assist against like the Holocaust or something. Like, what the fuck is the morality of this evil Krampus creature?
Right. Well, and so part of it too is, as you were saying that, I was like, what if Krampus is Nazi Germany, right? What if the lack of Christmas spirit and the way she depicts it in the story that she tells, which is told so beautifully. I love whenever there's like a memory or a story and it goes into this like really cool animated like
inspired style by like stop motion, but I think computer animated. It was really cool.
Yeah, I loved that style. And so like the way that she tells the story, there's a little bit of like my own wondering of what it's like, because her memories of it are as a child. It's not an adult memory, so it's different. But what if it is that she was moved into a Jewish ghetto? So there, it's Jewish people who are, of course, not going to celebrate Christmas, but also there's economic devastation that is happening. And legit scarcity of resources because they're being taken by all of the Nazis. And so there is fighting over, right? Like if you're in a concentration camp, yeah, there was fighting like over breadcrumbs and those sorts of things. And what if that is the context? And then Krampus coming in is Nazi Germany and sending people to the gas chambers. Like, what if it is the Holocaust? What if Krampus is the Holocaust?
Yeah, I love this interpretation because, like, I don't love it, but I mean, I love the brilliance of it and the insight because it feels there's this really, especially in this country, and this is an American film. Mm-hmm. So, like, there is this far right assumption that Christmas needs to be some sort of national holiday and everybody needs to participate. Mm-hmm. And so that like gives Krampus that whole new light of like this, like I am forcing you to participate in not just participate, but participate in a very specific way because the family was mm-hmm. still celebrating Christmas. They just didn't get along with each other.
Yeah.
So like, yeah. So yeah, I really dig that interpretation. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it makes it even more of a horror film, right? Mm-hmm. And it gets into more of the films that we're starting to see more of now that depict real life horror, like racism and white supremacy as horror, as the horror that they are. And I like that. And And I didn't have this coming in to this conversation. I didn't like there was something when she was telling the story where I was like, I will always think of grandparent age, German, and think of the Holocaust. Like that is always where my mind is going to make connections. And so then when it's about Christmas spirit and like there are plenty of Jewish people and Jewish kids who were somewhat told about Christmas or like who the families tried to teach them about Christmas so that they could blend some or so that they were less at risk. Yeah. Right. So it makes sense that she could have been from a Jewish family mm-hmm. and still had this experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I also kind of tied in with that is just this reoccurring trope in all genres of film, but it comes up again and again in horror film, which is like this lack of trust in the elderly who are usually mm-hmm. like coming to warn you of something and you're mm-hmm. just like, oh, they're old, they don't know what they're talking about, and all this kind of ageism tied in with that. And it just never works out well. We'll see this in a lot of movies we cover on here.
Yeah, but that's true. And there are cultures, right? A lot of Native cultures have a much higher respect for elders than like dominant white supremacist cultures. And yeah, there's like the wisdom of elders, and there's a lot of complicated things in age dynamics all around in reality. But yeah, the wisdom of elders is frequently dismissed, just as it is for mm-hmm. Omi, until finally they have no other explanations. They have no other options. They have to listen to her. And then she's like, well, I was trying to tell you.
But it's one of those things, but it's also one of those things that kind of are deconstructed in that meta way throughout the film. Like when Toni Collette, I can't remember the mom's name, but Toni Collette is the actress who is saying, oh, get Omi out of the fireplace before she burns the house down. And Max goes over mm-hmm. and is like, nope, she made hot chocolate. And like, there's also this other aspect of keeping the fire hot to keep Krampus away, which she's doing. But like, she clearly mm-hmm. knows what she's doing. It's just this lack of respect and trust and just assumption that she doesn't.
And there's an implication. This is another piece of it, right? There is an implication that she is incompetent. Right. Especially and the incompetence of elders.
She can't speak English.
There you go. Right. Like mm-hmm. there's a sense of like an assumption that she is incompetent, an assumption that she probably has dementia as an explanation for why she's in the fire. And because she doesn't speak English.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
all of that is exacerbated. And like, she speaks a European language. So for other, like, I just watched this, the half of it. And the dad in that speaks Chinese primarily and speaks some English with a heavy accent and with, I don't know how best to say it, but like not with the white, what is considered white standard grammar. And has not gotten promotions or raises or anything because of that. And that, like, this is one of those times when, like, it's German, but it also is having that impact. And then, like, there's also a, if it were a non-white language, how much worse would that be? It's a little different because it's family, and so you're still, like, it's your own heritage. But, I think it's hard. It's I don't think that's totally deconstructed in the movie, right? Like, there is some, would you please just listen to the elder in the room who's telling you the thing? Like, we get to the point of listening to her, but we don't all necessarily get all the way into all of those specifics, which is why we talk about them.
Yep.
I
have a few more things to get into quick. One is, I guess this is the first thing I'll get into because it relates to the other, so, which is this good-bad dualism depicted throughout the movie. More specifically, it's not just like Santa brings toys for good girls and boys and envy kids. It is this turning into like belief versus disbelief. And so there's this kind of connection to like you have to have a certain amount of faith in St. Nicholas, Santa, Christmas, something in your family. And if you don't, that is that disbelief that Krampus comes to punish you for. And even so, like, that's not clearly put throughout the whole film either, because like there's that lovely conversation, and I really love this conversation as the description of faith between Max and his dad. When Max says, do you really believe in all that talk about like family and stuff, and his dad Adam Scott says, I want to. And I just love that. Like, I feel like that's kind of the point of saying things like the creed every single Sunday in church and stuff like that. It's a way of actively wanting to participate in a faith, even if you are not at a place where you personally believe all the things you're saying in it. Same thing with communion. The best way to come to communion is, Luther says, is to know that you're unworthy to receive. But beyond that, like, there's this notion in a lot of open communion practicing traditions where it's like, it's not necessarily about what you believe, but it's about like being in the presence of a community that is the more important portion of communion.
Yeah, so. In the congregation that I'm serving now, part of the welcome to communion is like a couple different sentences that kind of create false binaries, but in an attempt to be merisms, right? To say anyone from here to there and everything in between. And one of them is welcome those of you who depend on this meal for your life, and those of you for whom it is a strange thing. And every time I say that, I'm like, yes, and like both and. Yep, absolutely. Those are both me. And yeah, so I love that space of the dad wanting to believe things, but also Max, right? Like, he is at a place in his particular age and the kids around him that he wants to believe it. And he wants to protect that belief of younger kids. And it's tricky because we don't always, it's rarely ever that clear cut.
And Omi defines the true spirit of Christmas as something other than family. She specifically says the true spirit of Christmas is giving and sacrifice. Which is kind of a little weird and problematic, but I won't get into that unless you want to say something about that. But like, And just naming that, it's not family, so that's a rarity in Hollywood movies.
That in and of itself is literally one of our categories for Advent misspending because it's so rare. But yeah, I don't think that's the true meaning of Christmas. It's one of the meanings of St. Nicholas was like generosity to protect people from being sold into slavery. Sacrifice maybe more of a meaning around like Holy Week.
Yeah.
I do think that there is this space, this brilliant space that is created of like biofam as nightmare. I went in a like nightmare, like what is nightmare? This whole thing is a nightmare, right? And that's partly how I got, I think, to my interpretation of the end of the movie, but also like capitalism, like the opening scene is like capitalist nightmare. This bio family is a nightmare. There's like eugenics conversation, like the one-off comment of like people should have to take a test, an IQ test or whatever, before they're allowed to breed. And it's just like so many of these things are nightmares, but it's all like under the breath. Like a comment under the breath or out of the side of your mouth or whatever. And then you get to Omi and Max and their relationship to Krampus. And it is, you have to face it head on, right? Like Omi locks them out and faces Krampus head on and lives. And so that's like this whole other complicated thing, right? But then ultimately Max is like, no, I am like here to face this and to and to apologize for the ways that I am responsible for this whole mess and to try to change it, which is like this whole journey of reparations.
What a good movie. I'll just say that. I love this movie. There was something I was going to say, but I lost it. That's okay. Do you have anything else for your deep dive?
I secretly was wishing for part of it that Krampus would come and visit because I want the snow. We still have not had snow yet, and I'm understanding that this is part of reality in Maryland these days, but it is still sad, and I am still sad, and we were maybe going to get snow on Christmas, except that it seems to be more likely to be an ice storm or rain, which is unfortunate.
That's real. Yeah. Oh, Maryland. I guess I shouldn't say it's actively snowing right here, right now, where I am recording. So
can you please just send it this way?
I wish I could.
You can send some pictures too, and maybe that'll help it. Like
when I get a new phone, I will definitely do that. Right now, my phone is messed up, the camera. Anyway, but yes, I also loved kind of the setup is almost the exact same as Christmas Vacation. If you've ever seen that comedy from the 1980s, which Chevy Chase, basically upper middle class white family gets invaded by their relatives, their poor relatives for the Christmas season, and who arrive in a trailer with all their kids, and the little boy doesn't speak. Like it, I feel like it's intentionally like referencing that, but I just love this horror sheen over top of it, and that also allows to kind of deconstruct some of that stuff. But let's get to rating the movie then. Since this is Christmas, we don't have to use nightmares unless you want to, but I feel like we could use like those demonic little gingerbread men or something.
I was thinking coal, but yeah, the Ooh, demonic Colbert, gingerbread men, I forgot about them.
And Santa's elves were horrifying. Like, oh, some of the creature effects in here were so good. And it really holds up, because a lot of it, I think, was practical stuff enhanced with CGI. But anyway, great stuff. So out of 10 demonic gingerbread people, I will rate this 9. I really, really liked it. My favorite kill is the kid getting swallowed by the Jack in the Box with that horrifying set. Like, that was like true blue horror. It was horrifying and amazing. So I loved it. What about you?
I will rate it. I think I'll give it an 8.5. Like, yeah, nice. This is bad because I like don't know what I would rate it beforehand, and I intentionally am not like thinking about that. But then as we talk about it, then the conversation itself becomes part of the thing. So it always, like, I think almost every time, unless we're like just tearing apart the movie completely, it raises the rating for movies for me.
Love it.
My favorite kill, I think, has to be Howard. Because it's a good one. And it's finally the space to sacrifice. Like, there is a space of sacrifice of, like, if you're going to talk about being the shepherd, then lay down that life for your flock. Like, go to it, bud. Also, he is the most significant embodiment of toxic masculinity. So, I'm like,
yeah,
off with you. Yeah. Also, our other category, our other rating, not, I don't know, rating, but I have to figure out what we're calling this, tracker? Our other segment. What?
Scare tracker?
Jump. Our scare tracker. Stump
scare tracker? I don't know.
Yeah. Is how many jumps for this movie? So I had half a jump. I don't remember exactly where it happened, but I remember having like half a jump. What about you, Pace?
I full on had a jump in here. I don't remember where. I think it was the Jack in the Box, maybe, yeah. Jump.
And it was after I had had the half jump. So I was surprised that I didn't also jump at that. But I was very excited when I was like, oh, now we both get to track jumps.
Yay. So, I will be remiss if I didn't say there's just some really fun one-liners in here. Chris Dougherty has a great sense of humor, but I love like when they're like, why do rich people get all this free stuff? And then she's like, I don't know, Democrats.
Yeah. I'm
so hard at that. So that. Much cute little stuff in there. Witty moments. Yep. Our next movie is going to continue the holiday theme. We will be covering Terror Train from 1980. It's set on New Year's Eve, and it's just a fun, really early 80s slasher movie. So I'm excited for Emily to experience her first like true slasher, late 70s, early 80s slasher. So golden age slasher, even. So
yeah, I'm excited too. We'll see how it goes.
And it has David Copperfield in it, the magician.
Ooh, nice.
Playing a magician. Who would have thought?
What?
So, Anyway, that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get exclusive access to movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, so much cheaper than the weird jack-in-the-box things.
I imagine, or those. Snow globes. Or
snow
putting
globes.
Your family in a snow globe. Snow globes.
Or putting your family. I imagine resin is also expensive to like build your own one. So yeah, much cheaper than all that shit. Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter @HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time.
Hell hath no fury like a parent whose kid was swallowed up by a Jack in the Box. And also, a bit of advice, eat your gingerbread before it eats you.
Love it. I was actually going to use almost something exactly like that one. So as soon as I saw you type it in, I'm like, I'm just going to let Emily say it. Because that's exactly, the gingerbread one is almost what it's going to do.
Well, you, anyway. I was typing it when you were talking about the gingerbread, and I was like, oh, yeah.